Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 16th, 2002, and this session at Holden Village is entitled Job, Jennifer, and Jesus, The Pain of Suffering Unjustly and Alone. It is presented by Norm Hubble, and it is tape number HAN 2002-12. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming. A few faces are new from yesterday. A couple of new faces, yes. So I will need to do a little bit review. This is a little different, Norman Hubble. I do the Purple Puzzle Tree, and I'm a kind of ham at a performer. And I do Bible studies, which are designed to challenge people to make them really rethink the gospel. But this particular series is a little different in the sense that I'm really very much aware that in this I often touch some of the soft points, the pains, the anguish of people. And so I think we need to feel free to be open, but don't feel that you have to. But at the same time, know that I'm quite conscious that the story and the things that I'm talking about are very real and very painful and often hurt people. I do not want to hurt you, but I do know that people are hurting. And I'm quite conscious of that. And at the end of this session, we might talk about one of the ways that we can help to ease that hurt, because it's real. I preached a series in Lent last year on Job, Jennifer, Jesus at the congregation. It was the younger people of the church who wanted me to take over for 6 months while the pastor was gone. And we did this series in Lent. And as a result, we had a large number of people who came and who wanted to have healing. And as a result of that process, we introduced the rite of healing as an integral part of our Eucharist. And I can talk more about that later. So that the kind of things that happen if you come to the Eucharist in my church there now, most times you can have the body and the bread, but you can also have a laying on of hands and the healing. So that the Eucharist becomes the vehicle of healing for people who are really hurting. You can choose it, you don't have to. And it's very powerful and very helpful for people who are in great pain. So you understand that I'm quite aware that this discussion is a little bit different than some of the others. And feel free, if you want to say something. I'm not asking that, but we might have an opportunity to do something like that also later on. For those who were not here yesterday, let me briefly summarize yesterday's session, because you need to know where it comes from. Job, Jennifer, and Jesus. I began with the story of Job, and we took the first part of the story of Job, where Job is, God is in the heavenly council, and he's there with the accuser called Satan, and they have a discussion. And God says to the Satan, where have you been? And he says, oh, I've been wandering to and fro on the earth. And God says, well, have you seen my servant Job? He is absolutely the best, the most spectacular human being you'll find. Satan says to him, well, it's all your fault, God. If you hadn't blessed him so much, he wouldn't be so good. Take it away, I'll bet he curses you. God said, I bet he won't. I bet he will, I bet he won't. So the deal is on. You have a wager in heaven about this person on earth. And it's a very, very unfair moment, because Job knows nothing about the wager. So Satan takes away all of his property, all of his produce, all of his merchant activities, and all of his children. And then Job says, The Lord has taken, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Now that pious answer is a denial of his reality. So the first phase of what happens when somebody is in great pain or hurt, something is hurt, is often the pious platitudes that we hear in church. You know, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. And Job stays in denial for the first two chapters. He doesn't face what really has happened. And so the first of the principles that I articulate for counseling out of this is, let the people, let all the pious platitudes go. And there are lots of them. Like, oh, Jesus wanted your baby for an angel. Some of those platitudes, you see, ultimately do not allow the person to face the realities and come to terms with it. Then Job goes to the point, after 7 days of sitting on the ash heap, he comes to the point where he actually then begins to scream. And he screams, he curses the day he was born, he curses all kinds of things. He doesn't quite curse God. Close to it, but doesn't quite. His wife suggests, why don't you curse God and die? That would be the best form of euthanasia I could imagine, she says. Let God do the killing. No, he's not about to do quite that. He keeps on the platitudes. And the first two chapters, Job is in denial. Chapter 3, Job begins to face reality. The scream, the screaming, and the cursing. And he gets to the point of suicide, to the verge of suicide. He says, oh, how wonderful it would be in the land of the dead. Because in the land of the dead, you don't have kings and servants. You don't have taskmasters. Everybody's equal and everybody's resting. It would be wonderful. So you have that second stage. But the important part of stage 2 is what I call the right to scream. And the people who go through hell in one way or another need to be able to scream. Let it out. Let it go. And I don't mind if you've got a screaming room in the back of your church or in the front of your church. A screaming, the chance to scream and let it go is as cathartic a starting point. It's not the end, but it's an important part of the process of healing in a spiritual way. I'm not pretending to be a psychiatric nurse or a counselor. I am not a psychiatrist. I am simply following what I think are the steps that are found in the book of Job as to how to come to terms spiritually with something that vicious that happens to you. Now, some of my psychiatrist friends think I'm odd, others think that's okay. But that's fine. I'm going through what I believe is a valid way revealed through the book of Job and confirmed by what Jesus said. Now Jennifer is a young woman when I first knew her. And Jennifer, one day, was working as a waitress in a restaurant. And her husband was home, supposedly looking after her little boy, James. Then she got a phone call. Your house has been burnt down. She raced home. Her boy, James, had been burnt alive. The door had been locked and he couldn't get out. And the husband had been in the pub drinking and had disappeared. She lost everything. And that led to a breakdown. She was in an institution. And in that institution, I came to see her. And she said, oh, I really don't want to live anymore. But I don't have the courage to take my life. I said, but what else is there? And she said, oh, that I had never been born. And that's exactly the first lines of Job chapter 3. I wish I'd never been born. I understood now what Job was about in many ways through this woman, Jennifer. Anyway, she goes through great pain and great shame. And then finally, I've come to realize that her anger and her hatred against what's happening is related to a deeper pain. That is that when she was a teenager, her uncle had come several times to the house to babysit, and he had sexually abused her, and she had lived with that pain, and nobody would want to know about it. Because the elder had been that uncle had been an elder in the church, and nobody would assume that he could possibly do that. That's the story so far. And whenever I preach it, after about 4 weeks, I say, I hope this has a happy ending. What we need to do now is to take these two stories and link them up again. And I'll just continue on with the story briefly of Jennifer so you understand. What happened was that Jennifer's friends, all those people who used to be friends of hers, one by one no longer were friends. They said, even if they didn't say it aloud, assumed that she was to be blamed. You must be a bad mother to leave your child at home. And so the shame and the blame of it just continued. She felt alone. And it's sometimes called in circles, counseling circles, the second wound, where the victim is abandoned in the pain. The victim is seen to be guilty. The victim is seen to be wrong. And when Jennifer tried to tell her parents eventually what the uncle had done, they said, "You naughty girl, don't make up such lies." Nobody wanted to believe her. And I have frequently found that. Nobody wants to believe the woman who's been abused, or even the boy that's been abused. And it happens so often. But when it happens close to you, the first thing to do is to believe it. Accept it. Otherwise, there's going to be that second wound immediately. The moment it happens in your circle, somebody says to you, so-and-so has abused me or hurt me or touched me. If they have the courage to say it, say, "Yes, I believe you," because that otherwise you leads to the second wound immediately. The sense of being abandoned.
Even if you acknowledge it, it leads to a second wound anyway, because they don't believe that you believe, even if you do.
Well, you've got to make it clear, "I believe you." The affirmation of the belief is very important. Now, let's go to Job and see what happens to him. If you look at Job chapters 4 and 5, after Job has finally cursed and screamed and said, "Why on earth did this all happen to me?" Then in chapter 4 and 5, Job's friends say, "We will comfort you. We will comfort you." And their comfort is, of course, absolutely no comfort whatsoever. And so they say to Job, for example, right at the very beginning, Eliphaz has this wonderful speech. He said, "I had a vision last night, and I will tell you what it's all about, Job. I had this vision. Just listen. A word came," it's Job 4:12, and it's just so cruel. Now, and it's linked to the, sometimes Lutherans have used this for the basis for the doctrine of original sin as well. "Now a word came stealing to me, my ear received the whisper of it, amid the thoughts and the visions of the night. When deep sleep falls on mortals, dread came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face. The hair of my flesh bristled. It stood on end, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was a silence, and then I heard a voice. The voice said, 'Can mortals be righteous before God? Can human beings be pure before their Maker?'" So he has this revelation, and the revelation is, you're a bloomin' sinner. All human beings are sinners, And sometimes in our Lutheran doctrine, we've quoted that text as justification for original sin.
Yes.
One of the tricks of the Orthodox and comforters here to prove that, well, you couldn't possibly be right. Human beings are born sinful. Therefore, you're a sinner. Therefore, you deserve this. So time and time again, you get this concept that people deserve what they get. So the friends in the first two chapters, and it goes on and on and on, keep saying, you must have done something wrong. Think hard, huh? And chapter 5 does the same thing. I'm just going to give you a couple of verses which really make it very clear how. Look at chapter 8. When Bildad talks, he says, well, I tell you what, if your children sinned against him, he delivered them into the power. In other words, all your children died because they were sinful. So they deserve it too. Nice stuff, isn't it? Great comfort. Great comfort. And finally, I'll just give you one more. Chapter 11, Zophar. Zophar's line is really so cool. You say, verse 4, my conduct is pure and I am clean in God's sight. Oh my God. Oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and then he would retell you the secrets of wisdom, which he does at the end of the book. For wisdom is many-sided. Know that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves.
You got off easy.
Isn't that ugly? And that's the fringe, you see. They are making the... For them, there's a very fundamental question that if you sin, you suffer. But the friends are arguing the opposite. They're saying, you're suffering, therefore you must sin. You cannot reverse the argument.
Isn't that the Hebrew tradition, though?
They're challenging it, you see. Job, you see, challenges the belief. The whole book challenges the belief that if you are suffering, if you're going through hell, whatever it is, therefore you must be a sinner or committed some great sin. And you deserve it. And we do it. You go to hospital, some lady is dying of cancer. Pastor, what did I do to deserve this? The line still goes on, doesn't it?
I think when we suffered all those miscarriages, people kept trying to be helpful by saying, did you sleep with an electric blanket? I've heard that would have caused it. Did you drink coffee? Maybe that would have caused it. Did you do this? Did you do that? I know they were meant well meaning, but it really didn't help.
Absolutely. Because your argument is you must have been the cause of it back here.
Cause somehow. Your own suffering.
Even if the cause is not sin, it's silliness or something, isn't it? So this argument, and it's very important to break this nexus between suffering and sin. It's important to break that nexus. There are lots of places in the Bible where it says, you do this and God will punish you. This is a very different question. The question is, somebody's going through hell, you don't automatically, to comfort them, to help them, say, well, what the hell did you do? What did you do? You know?
Yeah.
There's also a more subtle form, it seems, like, why can't you pull yourself up by your bootstraps? But the more subtle forms these days is, can't you laugh your way out of your illness? Can't you just think positive things and get yourself out of this situation?
Now what I'm saying is the first point of call to Job was not to laugh his way out of it, but to scream. Scream bloody murder. The right to scream is fundamental. And then the right to say to these people who are trying to tell you, I am not guilty. I have done nothing to deserve this. Why assume that I'm somehow guilty of something? Now, sometimes people do things wrong. If you go around, you know, all the world having intercourse with all sorts of people, you may well get syphilis. But that's the natural
But
it's a consequence and after consequence of the action.
But just because I am somehow or other suffering something doesn't mean that I've committed sin. Yeah.
I think it's as human as breathing, that even a child whose parents divorce will say, it's my fault.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a human need, that it's better to feel that somehow you deserved this, that somehow it's a power thing, that I did something that caused this, therefore this will never happen to me again if I do something different. That is less threatening, less scary than feeling like it just happened.
Yes, and then finding it. Yeah. And it may end up being that you come back to the same point, but you've got to give people the right to break this nexus and say, look, and Job is an absolute clear-cut case. Job has committed no sin whatsoever. And the Bible, as a piece of literature, this is set up powerfully to make it clear that Job is not in any way to blame. You could argue with Israel or somebody else that there was, but in this case, Job is totally and totally innocent of anything. It's a setup. He doesn't even know why it's happened. And when we do know why it's happened, we say, how could God possibly do that? So you've got a problem, and you've set it up to face the reality of genuine innocent suffering. Okay? Now, this nexus needs to be broken, and it was true for Job, it was true for Jennifer, was it true for Jesus?
Absolutely.
When they bring him before Pilate, they say, we accuse you of literally perverting the nation, is the reason. You are perverting this nation. And Pilate says, I can't find any fault. Oh yes, he's perverted the nation. They have to find some fault in this man. So he too is accused innocently, as we well know. But the accusation is as powerful and ugly as it comes. Now, the next part of the story is the story of how finally, after having Job never ever agrees. Now some people say, well, Job, he's a human being, he's a sinner. Job never ever agrees that he is guilty. He's the example of how you can fight the system, as it were, that wants to do that. And the friends for 20 chapters keep telling him he's wrong, that he never gives in. So you come to the point where Job says, the only way out for me, and it's an interesting way that you even think about it for yourself, the only way out for me is somehow or another to take the matter to court. The struggle for justice. Job wants justice. Now, how does Job want justice? If you've got a court, even in the ancient world, you had a judge, who may be an elder in the city gate. You have a judge. You have a prosecuting attorney, which in Hebrew would have been called the accuser, or the Satan. Remember where they were up in heaven and there was one, was a prosecuting attorney. Then you've got somebody who's going to be the defense attorney, or what's the right word for it?
DA.
Yeah, you call it a DA, that's right. The advocate, the person who's on your side. The advocate. And over here, you've got the person who is the plaintiff or the victim. Now, when you look at that picture immediately, who do you put as the judge?
God.
God. Right. Where do you put Job?
He's the plaintiff.
He's the plaintiff. And you have, in the background, you've got the Satan over here. But you've also got the three friends, haven't you? They have done a very good job of this. And there's nobody over here, is there? Now, Job is an absolutely brilliant book in that what Job says is, what I want to do is put God on the stand. Job is about taking God to court. How am I going to get justice against this, the person who's done this to me? I want to take God to court. And you have this wonderful section in chapter 9 and 10 where he first gets the idea. What if I took God to court?
Back up, please. Sorry.
What if I took God to court? Now, if you look at chapter 9 and you go to verse 15, the whole chapter is about it, but and chapter 10 as well. Though I am innocent, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. In other words, he calls God his accuser now. If he summoned me and he answered me, I don't believe he would listen. He tends to be that way. He would crush me with a tempest or whirlwind, which is exactly what does happen at the end of the book. And he multiplies my wounds with cause and makes me look worse. He won't even, if God hits town, I can't even get my breath. He fills me with bitterness. If it's a contest, well, he's stronger than I am. If it's a matter of justice, who can summon him to court? Who can get him there? I want to put God on trial, but it's proven hard to get God into court. You follow? It's brilliant. Though I am innocent, verse 20, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. So at this point, he's contemplating God coming here. The problem is God takes the side of both judge and accuser. He's not God, my advocate. He's on this side. And I'm stuck down here, and I look worse every time I open my mouth. So his great dream is to get justice. But the problem is that the person who has hurt me is God. So how do I get God to court? How do I get God?
Excuse me.
We don't have time to go through the long and wonderful series of reflections that he has. But there are three passages where he says, there's three passages which talk about his dream for an advocate. Somebody who might stand beside me. Before I do that, I need to go back for one moment to chapter 6, I think it's 24. Job says to the friends, what a bunch of helpless and useless creatures you are. You're all like streams. I come to the stream for a bit of water and you're dry, you're useless. And then he has one very key verse. He says, oh that I had a friend. Oh that I had a friend. Because a friend is someone who stands beside you when you lose faith in God. Extraordinary text. A friend is a person who'll be there even when you lose faith in Shaddai, in God.
Where's that verse?
It's 14.
This very man should have the devotion of his friends even though he forsakes.
Yes, 6:14.
Okay.
614?
614. A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends.
14. And it partly depends on your translation. The correct translation is that the one who is in despair, the one who is in despair needs a friend, even if he doesn't fear God any longer, Shaddai any longer.
Where's the reference? No,
614. 6:14. The important point I want to make is that he's talking about friend. Tell me a story. You tell me one place in the Old Testament where that somebody is a friend.
Jonathan with David.
David and Jonathan, tell me another one. It's the only story. Friend is a rare character in the Bible, in the Old Testament. When Jesus says, be my friends, it's real. A break with tradition, because you had the concept of families and households and all the rest of it, but friend, someone, is really quite a rare concept. But Job introduces the concept of a friend, that is somebody who is your advocate, even if God is against you. That's an extraordinary concept, which is really a Job concept. It's original, powerful. And so Job then, in three different places, chapter 9, 16, and 19, three different places, explores the idea of a friend, an advocate. Now let's just take a quick look at these three passages. 9 verse 32 and 33. For God is not a mortal the way I am, so that I can answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no, what's your translation say?
Umpire
between us. Somebody who can put one hand on my shoulder and one hand on God's shoulder and say, all right, come together. Isn't that great? Somebody who can actually mediate and get me and God into court together to have the matter resolved.
So that I would not be afraid of God anymore.
Yeah, because it's hard to get somebody, you're petrified. You see, God isn't just any opponent. He's a bit overpowering. And so to get this overpowering God into court with you is not easy. I really need somebody who's a mediator between God and humanity, you know, human beings, which is a...
Appeal to a higher court when there is none.
Yes, he's appealing to a higher court, and in a sense, of course, Jesus does eventually fulfill that function. Doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But, let's take the second text. It grows. Chapter 16. You're only getting the gems of this book, but it's all great. All right, 18, starting with verse 18. And you remember the story about Cain killing Abel? What happens after he's killed? The earth, the ground, cries out to God for justice. So Job says, verse 18, O earth, do not cover my blood. Let my outcry find no resting place. I believe that even now, in fact, my... What do you got?
Witnesses
in heaven, and he will vouch for me on high. So we've got another concept for it. This is, first of all, an umpire, or somebody who can stand between us. Then it's a friend, it's also a witness. So that even if... Remember we had the heavenly court, and the Satan was watching to see...
It also calls him an advocate, which actually is a stronger statement than witness. An advocate is somebody who not only witnessed, but who actually saw your side.
And the word witness is, I mean, all of these things put together, friend, witness, umpire, and the one that comes later, all put together would add up to the word advocate. Okay? So what you've got is somebody who has seen it happen and is willing to testify on my behalf.
See if I can phrase this succinctly. Job is talking as though God is doing these things to him.
Yes.
And maybe it's a subtle distinction, but it seems that it's Satan that's doing the things, but God isn't intervening. I know sometimes people say, well, God caused this or God caused that.
It's quite clear in the book of Job that Satan is simply the agent of God to do this. He is simply the one who carries out the agreed. God says, yes, this can happen to Job. So far as Job is concerned, it's not the messenger. Don't shoot the messenger. It's God that's the problem. And he's going straight
because
to the top.
Because he said it was okay. Because
he said, go ahead and do it. It's a deal. It was a wager.
Doesn't he say, basically, do anything, but just don't kill him?
Yeah, and then later on he says, tear his body up, but just don't let him die. We got to have him alive for the end of the book. don't let him die. It's crucial. So that's the second of these great ones. Now one more, and this is one you'll remember. You know the next one because you've sung it 100 times. Tap the next one, and you have to understand this third one in the light of the other two that we've read. It's the famous one in chapter 19, verse 23 and following. Oh, that my words were written down, or that they were inscribed in a book. Now, I'm ready to write down my case, you see. God's sitting up there looking, but I'm going to put mine in writing, which is a great thing. And it was an iron pen and lead engraved in rock. It'll be there forever, like the great persistent rock. I'm going to write it down. For I know that my, what?
Redeemer.
Yes, that's the next one. I know that my Redeemer lives. Now, if you remember my chapel thing the other day, the Redeemer is the one who buys back and rescues you. So Job is now looking for somebody who is going to be the advocate, who will redeem him, that is, take his case and redeem and clear his name. And he goes on and says, even if I'm dead and worms are eating my body, this might happen after I'm dead, but it's going to happen. I'm sure I'm going to get clear to this. In a certain sense, of course, the book does clear him because it's written down. So the Redeemer is nothing to do with... it's not a prophecy about Jesus. It's an anticipation of Job of what you need if you're going to ever get right with God. Now, that's the story of the court case. Where does it go? Where does the court case end? Eventually, I don't have time to go through it all. Chapters 29 to 31, which you don't have to read at this point. Those three chapters, Job writes down what his case is. He presents his case, his past life, and his present situation, and his claim. That's his testimony. It's a legal document in which he writes down his case and writes it out. So all of this is preliminary reflection until he gets to the point of writing down his case and presenting it to God and says, all right, I'm going to court whether you're there or not, God. Brilliant. Now, let me just give you the ending of that, where he actually takes God to court. The end of chapter 31. The key verses of taking God to court. Verse 35 and following. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. Now, it's a technical word there for hearing in court. Is it just any word? Hearing in court. Here is my
signature.
He signed the document. Here's my signature. Let
the Almighty.
Let Shaddai. That's his name. He doesn't just. Almighty's not a good translation. That's his name. Let Shaddai answer me. It's the name of God the Great. Let Shaddai answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my. What does he want? He's given, this is his document, now he wants what?
His accuser.
He wants the document from God. Then I'd know what the heck the specific charges were. And if I did, then comes this wonderful bit of humor. If I had the document from God, then I would put it on my shoulder, I'd turn it into a crown and wear it on my head. I often wonder whether he isn't saying, well, you know, I know it's not going to come, but so I would, and then I would give him an account and I would approach him like a king. I would come like a king with a crown of his accusations sitting on my head. It's a lovely little bit of humor right in the middle of all that. The very end, two things. Here's my document, the chapters that preceded, and I want yours, God. I want your testimony. That's it. My case is bailed out. So it's important to know that the book comes to that point in 31 where Job has explored what might be like, then he writes his testimony, and then he calls God to court. This is my document and here's my signature. Extraordinary stuff. Reflection on that before we move on. Anybody?
One thing that strikes me was with respect to the comment over here about whether or not God is the one who causes the misery or God just stands by and allows the misery to happen. that's another issue when people are victimized by other people or when bad things happen to good people is this issue of whether or not God caused it or God allowed it. It's sort of moot. I mean, because if God's not interventionist in stopping evil from happening, then in a sense, God does cause that, or sin causes it, and God allows it.
It's important to recognize Job knows nothing about what happened up in the sky in the council. He knows nothing about Satan. Satan never gets mentioned in any of the friends or Job's discussions. He's out of the picture. It's Job, God, the friends, and whoever the advocate might be.
I was just thinking, I appreciate this interpretation, this focus here, because reflection on it, it's very empowering.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
So, the important thing, there are two steps. The right to dismiss some of the pious stuff to start with, the right to scream, and the right to grieve, the third, I'll put those up for the moment, they really are important that we recognize these as steps in what I call a spiritual counseling process for this. One is the right, to say no to the pious answer, the right to scream, and the third one, which I didn't quite articulate before, is the right to grieve. Because let's face it, you often lose everybody, even your friends. And you may lose hope. The right to grieve, and now the right to go for justice. In other words, to go for justice, not anybody. Job says that I'll go for justice with God. I'll go straight to God. I want to put God on trial because this is not fair. It's not the way it ought to be. And while there might be other forces that caused it, Job knows of none. As far as he's concerned, he takes God seriously. And lots of people say, I don't believe in God anymore because of what's happened, and that's understandable. But Job doesn't work that way. He believes in God. He's going to have it out with God. And if you take God really serious, you're going to confront God with it. And so that's why you're perfectly right. This is a very empowering step, this one. That justice is not simply dealing with some human problem. It's often sometimes coming to terms with God. Now comes... So we've got... Job has put God on the spot. And a sense in the Jennifer story to parallel it. What happened with Jennifer is that one day she gave me a call early in the middle of the night. And she says, my husband has called me. He wants to talk to me again after several years. And suddenly that moment when she heard her husband's voice stung her back into reality. Instead of just feeling sorry for herself, she wanted to have justice. She wanted to have it out. And bit by bit, the justice was not only justice with her husband, but justice with her uncle who had abused her. So eventually we got to the point of her willing to accept an advocate who would go and confront her uncle again. Confront her uncle after all these years with what had happened and what had been done. She wanted justice. And that was first step in the healing, but another step in the healing process, to actually come, to be willing to face, often you cannot do it on your own, but somebody who really does believe you and is willing to take, go with you to confront God or the enemy, whoever it might be. And that then happened. But before we get to the end of the story, any questions about this? This process of confronting God.
Did Jennifer feel abandoned by God?
Yes, but I said, well, let's see if we can confront God. And she did eventually. Now, how much time do I have left?
15 minutes. 15 minutes.
But we'll stay late.
Now, this, before I go, remember that Jesus likewise was abandoned. How was Jesus abandoned?
On the cross.
But before that?
All the disciples left.
Everybody left. He was declared guilty and nobody stood by him. His friends were gone.
Nobody challenged the court.
Disciples were gone. Nobody. Jesus had no advocate, did he?
No.
Peter said, I'll stand by you, come hell or high water. Didn't he? Mm-hmm. Peter said, I'll stand by you. Don't worry, Jesus, Buster, I'll always be there. He was the first one to deny him. Mm-hmm. And the cock crows. I have to tell you that one thing we do in my church at home is always have a children's start to the service. And when we had Peter, we had a young man who's president of the congregation now, who had a rooster. It was a pet rooster who did whatever he said. And he had this rooster sitting on the wooden cross while the kids went through the business of being deserting the cross and deserting Jesus, and the rooster stays there. We hear the cock crow. Mm. It was just shivering. And the rooster just sat there. I don't recommend you bring animals necessarily. But also, I do recommend, just on a side, one of the most powerful things is to have the children bring their animals and have a blessing in the animals. It's a very powerful thing to have happen, because they feel like their world is being included. Include the children's world in your worship. That's another one of my things. Now, important here, reckon the fact that Jesus was abandoned, but Jesus also was accused, and Jesus had no advocate. None at all. And we don't think about that often. And Jesus was totally shamed. Totally shamed. As you look at the picture of Jesus on the cross, what do you see? When your memories of pictures of Jesus on the cross. Jesus is bent over like this, a wound in the side, wounds in his hands.
Crown of thorns.
Thorns on his head.
Stripped of his clothing.
Yes, but is he? Most of the pictures I see, he's not really naked.
No, but...
He's naked.
He's naked.
We've covered it. We've covered a lot of Jesus' shame. Because you actually, in the ancient Roman world, you are stripped. You stand there without anything on. But we've carefully put a cloth around him in our Western world. He's shamed, and to be really shamed, you are naked, made naked.
Is the Western world the only world that has done that? Is Jesus naked?
Most other places too, a lot of places. In some of the worlds, like Africa, every once in a while you'll find a place where they actually do.
I have seen naked crucifixion in pictures.
And that's right. And that's the way it should be. I mean, if you want to be. Reflect the shaming of Jesus. It's not just the dying of Jesus. It's the shaming of Jesus. Yep. And so he bears the guilt and the shame that we feel. It's an important distinction. Very important in Australia when I do this business about working with the Indigenous peoples and Australians. They say, look, I'm not guilty. I didn't do anything in the past to the Indigenous Australians, murder them, massacre them, whatever. We may not have actually killed them, but we need a sense of shame for what we've done. It's part of our history. And I assume the same in this country. Now, Jesus, therefore, has no advocate. And in many ways, the parallel between Jesus and Job is powerful as you go all the way through. Now let's wind the story up. It's not easy to wind it up because it's a story of faith, and it's not a nice, simple, clean cut. You know, you always start off, I want an answer. Why? I want an answer. And you want the answer to be A, B, C, and very neat. The answer is not quite as neat as you might like. Before I give you the answer, I'm going to wait one more text. When Job makes his accusations, Job makes two lots of accusations.
One lot is about what God has done to him and people like him. The second thing is that Job, in various places, accuses God of being a God of chaos and disaster and everything else. And he goes all the way. He doesn't say, well, just done it to me. You've done it to everybody else. You ask the cows, he said. They'll tell you what it's like to live under God. He goes all the way. Ask the cattle. They'll know. They know what it's like to suffer. Now, if you go to chapter 12, I'm not going to read it in detail. Chapter 12, the second part of it, he says, God, I know your wisdom is remarkable, and your wisdom is such that you bring disaster on everybody, you destroy nations, you do all. So Job is...
They grope in darkness with no light. He makes them stagger like drunkards.
Yeah, there's a whole series of stuff. And at the very last part of it, he says, and everybody wanders around in tohu ba-bohu, which is... That's exactly the word that you've got at the beginning of creation, where everything is not yet formed. It's all a mess. It's all still unformed. So he goes all the way in all his accusations about God, and I don't have time to go through the details of it, but there's two main kinds of accusations. One is the what he God is doing to him, which is totally unjust, and what God tends to do to everybody and the whole cosmos. He goes all the way there. Now, what happens in the end of the book? I know I take a whole year to teach this class, but we're doing it in one lesson. This is the core of it, this court case. He has in 29 to 31 said, come to the court, this is my case, and I'll stand up there like a prince and face you, God. Chapters 38, that one doesn't work anymore.
Throw it on the floor, and I'll get it.
There we go. Yeah. 38 to 41 is God's answer from the whirlwind. Right? Now, I'm not going to go through that whole thing. But what's important is that God, the step one is that God answers. Job saying, or answer me. Then you have a nice little interlude with Elijah saying, oh, you silly, silly old man, you know. We know, just listen to me. I'll be your advocate. I've got all the answers. You know, we have Elijah who says the sort of anticlimactic answers, you know, which are great, but we don't have time to go through them. You know? Then God says, all right, who is the spirit? God answers. That's the remarkable thing. God does come to the court. God does appear. And God does it with great bravado, huh? And great flourish, right? Here I am, and now I write, who's this character trying to challenge me? If you got any wisdom, then listen to me. So then you have this wonderful speech. 38 and 39. Wow. This is great speech. And it's a great and fantastic speech, and I don't have time to touch on it, excepting that what it does is very close to modern ecology. It tells you about the mystery of how all the ordering of creation happens. And the stuff about the code of creation.
Is it relevant, though, to Job's question?
Not quite.
I don't think so.
It does answer part one of Job, that God is the God of chaos. Job, there's a big picture here. That may not be what Job wanted exactly. It doesn't quite answer the question, are you right or wrong? But it does say, look, Job, there's a remarkable world of mystery and stuff going on here you need to explore. So there's a kind of ambivalence. The answers aren't always black and white. The answer in this case is, think, Job. Think another level than you thought before. Then at the end of chapter 39, or beginning of 40, God says, is a key line, do you have to make me in the wrong for you to be right?
which verse?
Okay.
Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
I'll find it. Problem is, I quit.
That's 40 verse 2.
Yeah, 40 verse 2. Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? Anyone who argues with God must respond. And Job answered, see, I am small. And what shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I'm not going to go so much more, but God says, stop it. All right. I will question you. Verse 8. Will you put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you might be justified? Have you got an arm like God? Now, he challenges Job. Do you have to make me wrong for you to be right? He doesn't say. It's left as a question. It's left as a question. You're empowering. It's still there. He hasn't ended the court case. Now Job says, well, it seems like it's a bit overwhelming. I'm rather small in all of this. And look, Bethlehem's God, and then God says, but look, and God goes on and again. What is important finally is how it does end in chapter 42. And so much of the ending is condensed in a few verses. And in chapter 42, the first six verses, Job responds, and he keeps quoting God throughout this section. Oh yes, and then all this stuff. And eventually, at the end of it, in 42 verse 6, is a key line. It's not the end of the story, but it's a key line. Job 42:6 says, what's your translation? I despise myself
and repent in destination.
That's a terrible, terrible translation. It is absolutely terrible because it says nothing about him repenting. It basically says, and this is rather a problem if you don't know the Hebrew, because people want to see the proper sequence. You have to confess before, the ending. At the ending, you need to confess. It says, I, something or other, of dust and ashes. And the best way to translate it is, I give up on dust and ashes.
And turn away from?
Yeah, no more dust and ashes. I, nachamma, means I change my mind. Mm-hmm. About dust and ashes. Nothing to do with repenting of a sin, because he hasn't done anything wrong and he never ever admitted he was wrong. I give up, no more dust and ashes, which means that's the end of the court case. Forget it. I'm going to come and live with face reality. I'm not going to deal with.
I can't get justice here.
Well, or it might be that. It's simply, I can't anymore, I can't actually go on. I'm just going to forget this thing. I'm going to go back to living. I'm not going to sit and stew any longer.
What's the appropriate translation for the first part of that verse? Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. What's the despise?
If you look at the Hebrew there, therefore, he says, I'm going to change my mind about myself.
Okay. I reverse myself.
Yes, I reverse the way I've been functioning. I'm going to go back to living a normal life now and no longer face. But you see, God has not ended it. You haven't had God's last speech. Often people see 38 to 41 as God's last speech, but God has yet to speak again. What you've got is Job saying, all right, the court case is over. I'm going to go back. No more dust and ashes, which is sitting here, in the court, looking innocent. Because you went to court, what did you do? You made yourself look as miserable and victim and innocent as possible. Mm-hmm. And you wore dust and ashes. To remove the dust and ashes means to say the court case is over. All right, the case is over. But God's verdict is not over. Mm-hmm. God's verdict is still to come. And usually people have ended right there. That's not where they ended.
Well, Norm, I've heard the argument, though, that this next section, because it's prose, is later, and that shouldn't be in there.
I take the book as a literary structure, a literary unity. And if you look at frame narratives around the world, the frame is a part of the interpretation of the whole. And therefore you, if you take chapters 1 and 2 out, you have no idea what the rest's about. If you leave chapters 1 and 2 in, then you have to leave in at least this part, which is the ending. Because what does it say? God then comes and he pronounces his verdict. He talks to whom?
Friends.
He talks to the three friends and he says, all right, you guys, now here is my verdict. Now therefore, my wrath is kindled against you guys and you three because what?
You've not spoken.
You have not spoken truth the way that Job has. The verdict is given and pronounced to the three, with Job in the hearing. The Job did speak the truth about the scene, the situation, about what God, because God had done it and Job was innocent. He was. And that's a declaration of Job's innocence. And the friends had it backwards. I was going to say something else. Bat it backwards. Right? Now, if that's the case, if that's the verdict of God, and the friends are the ones who are sinful and guilty, you've got to do something about the
friends.
Friends. What happens? Suddenly, the whole thing gets reversed, right? And the story keeps doing this, you see?
The accusers become the accused.
So where are the three friends?
They're not.
The three friends are here now.
They're not on the hot seat.
God is here, and who becomes the advocate?
Job.
Extraordinary. We've wanted to have Job's been here. Job put God here. Now God puts the friends here. Brilliant story, but it's also powerful and meaningful in the sense that here now, Job's restoration, Job's healing is that God now points him to be
advocate
for his friends.
Advocate for his friends. So what have you got to do, you three friends? You've got to do, Job, you've got to go kill an animal, have a sacrifice, sit down, and eat with your three friends.
Who wrote the book?
I have no idea.
There's no... Did the frame... Was the authorship of the frame the same as the book?
I think so, but a lot of people know. If you look at my commentary, I make a strong case for saying it. Somebody put it all together.
You wrote a book about this particular...
I wrote a couple
commentary.
Of there's a commentary called, in the Old Testament Library series called, just called Job, in the Old Testament Library series, Westminster Press. But the argument, I read frame narratives around the world. Wonderful stories where you frame poetry with a story.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say, Norm's too modest. His book is the definitive work on the book of Job. Let's just say it.
Okay.
We don't need that. I want to finish the story here. What is the meaning? What is the significance of Job? What is the significance of Job sacrificing these animals and having a meal with the three friends? What is Job doing to the friends in effect?
Forgiving them.
Yes. This is the healing. This is the forgiveness. This is the moment which is the most meaningful in the whole book, but it takes the whole book to get to that point. And often it's ignored. When you sit down with a sacrifice in that context, you reconcile. It's reconciliation. And God has been the vehicle of that, the mediator of reconciliation.
Wow.
Now the story of Jennifer. Of course, let's take the story of Jesus first. When Jesus ends, he's on the cross, he's been abandoned, he has no advocate, he screams at God, and yet in the end he says, Father,
forgive them.
So we finally had the advocate. He came to Jennifer, came to her uncle several times, and finally she said, these lines will stay as powerful as ever. I want you to know you can no longer hurt me. In a sense, Job says the same thing in that last speech. I leave. You can't hurt me anymore. My husband stole my life, but you, my uncle, stole my soul. I am taking my soul back now because I faced you. And now I forgive you. That was after weeks, of course, but still. And then she, well, there were tears all around. To understand. But that moment of forgiveness happened here.
I think it's so powerful that that moment of forgiveness isn't healing for him, even though she's forgiving him for all of that wrong.
It's healing for her.
It isn't healing for him, it's healing for her. And that's the only way that...
See, a lot of times pastors would say, why don't you just forgive because an old man or whatever. But until the confrontation happens,
right.
Until the actual taken back from that person happens, the healing doesn't happen.
Yeah. Now, it almost leaves the other person with something then that they need to...
Then right.
Deal with themselves.
He had to.
That's right.
He's got his own process.
That's right. He's been confronted. And
his tears were there.
Yeah.
And I won't go beyond that point in the story. But what lots of people, and I want to now talk about something for tonight, possibility. Some people, a number of people have, when we did this in Adelaide and other places, people experience of abuse or pain or great loss or whatever, especially abuse, comes to the surface and they say, look, we would like to be part of healing if possible. And we have a rite of healing, as I said, we have it normally with our routine basis as part of the Eucharist. And it used to be a Hindley used to, Carolyn Lee used to have rites of healing. So we're raising the question of whether after Vespers tonight, some people who might like to have a special rite of healing, which I do, which follows on from this, if people would like to come, we'll be exploring the idea of having it next door in fireside quietly. The last Friday night is around the cross, so it's a very appropriate kind of way in which you end. You could just go straight from there to the fireside room and we'll have some candles.
This is fireside?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
You mean Creekside?
Creekside, I mean Creekside. Not this room, because this room tends to be generally used from next door. I don't know whether some of you would like that.
I would love that, but we're leaving today on the bus, so there's two of us that won't be here.
I'm sorry to hear about that. It's the best time to do it, though. Are there others who might like to? But we talked about the possibility of doing that. And if we don't, you don't have to say yes or no now. I'm saying if you think it's a good idea, we can.
It doesn't have to be big, does it?
What?
It doesn't have to be big for you.
Oh, no, it doesn't have to be big. No, I just wanted to get an idea of whether people supported the idea. And then if it's, I'll talk to people and we'll see whether we might make an announcement. We wouldn't do it in the big room there, we'd do it quietly, separately in the Creekside room, if that's okay with you. So those who would like to come, you'll get an announcement anyway.
One other approach to that is trying to incorporate that into the prayer around the cross itself, because in some, at least in part, that's one of the strains or one of the traditions that informs the prayer around the cross, as I understand. Not only
well, I can ask about that. In other words, I would go from... if somebody wanted to put their hand up and said, look, I would like a special...
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'll ask.
I've got to fit in with whatever the customs are here.
Yeah.
But that is true. That's not a bad idea.
Within the context, we do the similar prayer on the cross and everything, and it has that connotation.
Okay. All right, thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.